Blog Talk Radio.
On Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our hosts are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Jan Bushkai, Chuck Albright, Bill Joseph, Howard Mucci, Neil Holland, and me, Jim Hart. Last week's show covered several areas of interest to our hosts. The discussions that followed each subject caused a timing problem. We simply ran out of time before we could cover them all. We thought this week we would continue with those that we did not finish. Your participation is entirely welcome. Let's start off by introducing our hosts in Jacksonville, Margaret Bars and Neil Holland. How are you guys this evening?
Well, Jim, like the song Rainy Day in Georgia, it's been a rainy day here in Jacksonville. But you know what? Excitement is on the horizon. Hey, Neil. Would you like to let our host and our EAL listeners know the surprise news that you have for them?
Wonderful news, guys. You're not going to believe this, but got a call today from Frank Borman, and he wants to come on the show with us.
Very, very good.
April Fool.
April Fool, guys.
Thank you for that.
But we may have Frank Borman on a future show, and if we can find Frank Lorenzo, we'll put him in the ring together and see who wins.
Hey, don't forget Charlie.
Okay, back to you, Jim.
All right, thank you very much, Neil. You know, I wish you guys could send some of that rain down South Florida here. We are just dry as a bone. From Delray Beach, Florida, Jan Bushkai. Hello, Jan. How are things down there?
Well, I'm the producer and engineer tonight, Jim, and Jan is not with us tonight. Don't see her phone number on the board, so we'll go to our next host.
All right, from the Villages, Chuck Albright. How are you today, Chuck?
How you doing? I'm doing good. We've had a really nice day today. It's probably picture perfect. Right now we're sitting at 79 degrees, and we're looking at a low of 56 tonight. So we're going to have some really balmy, breezy weather tonight. Looks like about 20% rain, though. But it doesn't hamper all those 30,000 people that's out there on the golf courses, and, of course, the other 15 to 20,000 people who are dancing in our squares tonight. So come on by and say hi and really enjoy the festivities that we have here.
And good. Thank you very much, Chuck. From Roaring Gap, North Carolina, where Steve Thompson lives, I understand snow showers are in the forecast for this morning, for tomorrow morning. How's everything else up there in the Carolina Mountains, Steve?
Well, we had a hint of spring yesterday here in Roaring Gap, but about 30 minutes away on I-77, we had a 95-car pileup in the dense fog on I-77. Mm. And then tonight, as you mentioned, yes, old man winter is going to hit us over the head again with some snow flurries.
Well, Bill Joseph, a regular host on the show, is in transition from Grand Junction, Colorado, to Newport Richey, Florida. He'll be back with us as soon as his move is complete. Hurry back, Bill. We miss you.
There once was a passenger that stopped by the terminal gate, by the goons and geeks and the TSA thinks and the deputy sheriff sent by the state to implement their plan. They'd inspect her with a scan to x-ray her with their leering eyes, or touch her crotch and pinch her thighs. Oh, you can't scan me, I'd rather have a pat down. I'd rather have a pat down, face a pervert frisking. No, you can't scan me, no scanner risking. No scanner risking my DNA. Before she could board her flight, they made her wait and fret. Take off her shoes, take off her belt, because she was a threat. She might be a terrorist with a bomb hid up her dress. Security thinks that she might try to blow the plane out of the sky. Oh, you can't scan me, I'd rather have a pat down. I'd rather have a pat down, face a pervert's frisking. No, you can't scan me, no scanner risking. No scanner risking my DNA. Oh, you can't scan me, I'd rather have a pat down. I'd rather have a pat down, face a pervert frisking. No, you can't scan me, no scanner risking. No scanner risking my DNA.
Thank you, Luann. Wonderful singing.
Thank you.
I'm telling you, she has a great voice.
You didn't know I could sing like that, did you?
I sure didn't.
Jim, back to you.
All right. I understand that our guest is not going to be with us this evening, so I will continue on and ask Margaret to tell us what's on your mind tonight.
Well, Jim, there was an article that caught my eye recently about an economist who proposed a pay-as-you-weigh model for air tickets. And in other words, he queried, should passengers be charged for airline tickets based on their weight? Now, he posted this idea in the Journal of Revenue and Pricing Management, along with his controversial findings, saying that charging according to weight and space is a universally accepted principle, not only in transportation, but also in other services. He even went on to suggest three methods of implementing the scheme. Number one was a simple price per pound. Number two, a fixed low fare with heavier passengers paying a surcharge and lighter passengers being offered a discount. Now, his name was Bhatta. I'm sure I probably have mispronounced that, but it's spelled B as in Bob, H-A-T-T-A. And he said that charging overweight flyers, would help carriers recoup the cost of the extra fuel required to carry them, saying that reducing the weight on a plane by a little more than 2 pounds will result in fuel savings of $3,000 a year. Now, I checked another article with Samoa Air, and they were saying that you should base and the cost should be something like 20 cents per pound per 1,000 miles. Now, many people have argued that these policies are discriminatory and, in fact, humiliating. But this debate over passengers of size has been growing since, believe it or not, 2008 due to the rising price of jet fuel. And with about 30% of the American adults considered obese, this is probably going to be an issue. Now, I also found another article from 2008 in which Air Asia, it says X, is that Air Asia 10 or Air Asia X? I'm not sure, but anyway, it's out of Australia. And so the travel magazine reported that they were considering charging passengers by the pound in a bid to fight rising fuel prices and also to help the Aussies lose weight. So now we bring in a social issue into that. So in other words, though, who actually makes that final decision? And so some of them are saying maybe a gate agent, a flight attendant, or a pilot should make that determination. And although the Federal Aviation Administration does not regulate seat width, it does require passengers to be able to sit belted and with both armrests down to comply with safety standards. So I guess my question to the EAL host is, what do you think of this?
I've got 2 cents here. I think Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, ought to get a hold of this idea.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah, I think it might be something to look at. As a matter of fact, it would probably encourage me, if I wanted to fly a lot, to lose about 50 to 60 pounds. But I'm sure there would be some kind of formula that would be that would be in place to figure out, like per 1,000 miles or something like that. What do you guys think?
I think if you're too skinny, they're going to give you you're going to have a surcharge on that. See, to bring you up somewhere so they can have their cost break even at least. So the skinny people and the overweight people are in big trouble.
Well, if you've ever sat in a window seat beside someone sitting in a middle seat who the majority of their body was hanging over the seat, the armrest, then you will support such a program of the overweight passenger paying a surcharge.
Well, don't they do that now where if they're really overweight, they have to have accommodations, they have to pay for 2 seats?
Well, I think
I've heard of that.
Yeah,
I don't know about the rest of you.
Yeah, Southwest Airlines, they'll refund the cost of an additional seat to customers of size if the flight doesn't oversell. And I believe United Airlines last year also implemented a policy requiring obese passengers to buy a second seat, unless, of course, vacant seats were available on that flight.
Just for a little bike story, I remember helping because I was helping with the forklift. We had a oversized passenger from one of the Barnum and Bailey circus acts. He was close to 1,000 pounds. They had to put him on a platform on a forklift to get him up to into the plane. It was back in the days where you didn't have the jetways. You had to walk out, and I remember that. And he took up all 3 seats.
We had a back when I was flying the Convair in the Convair days. I remember, and I think it was Charlotte that we would pick him up. A famous wrestler, and Steve, you may remember this. His name was Haystack, and I can't think of Haystack's last name.
Yes, I remember.
And he would fly with us all the time, and of course he would fill 2 seats completely, left to right, from armrest to armrest. And I believe that, when situation was like Margaret says, when we're full, I think he paid first class, and or not first class, but 2 fares. But he never made a problem of it, and I don't think Eastern did either.
Well, let's continue on. This is so interesting. At this point, let me see who we have here. Chuck.
Before Chuck signs on, Jim, I see we have a caller from area code 770. If the caller at that area code would wish to say hello, then press 1 and say hello and join our conversation tonight.
I just pressed 1, Neil. This is Bob.
Hey, Bob. Well, I'm glad you're with us tonight. You got any comment about weight?
Well, my wife deals with this all the time at the airline she's working with, and she writes the standards policies. And that is true that they try to accommodate the overweight individuals in extra seats, or they end up having to buy the extra ticket if the plane's full and take 2 seats. It's a hard issue to deal with.
Well, would you tell us which airline your wife works for?
She's with Delta.
Of course, and she used to be with Eastern, right?
Right. Flew with Eastern about 17 years.
Okay. So is she still flying regular trips, Bob?
She bids a regular line. She left the office about a year ago. She wrote the Red Book that about 90% of it that the flight attendants carry their procedures manual, so she was very up to speed in health, safety, and security with Delta.
Okay.
She kind of gets
Bob,
checked
this
rides
is Steve
all the time.
Thompson. I don't recognize you. Can you tell us your last name?
Yeah, Bob Furman. I was hired by Eastern.
Oh, okay, Bob. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
That's right. You're the only Bob that worked for Eastern now. I remember.
I was just going to say
just,
she gives.
Just kidding.
Right. She was a standardization flight attendant, and just like she is here at home, she keeps everything in order, including me. But anyhow, I love every minute of it.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, yeah, stay with us, Bob.
I will.
Please, as long as you can.
Yes, sir.
Jim, back to you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry
to
interrupt you, but we want to talk to our guest as well on the phone.
All right, fine. We're going to go to Chuck right now, and he's going to tell us a bit about seats and contract maintenance. Chuck?
Well, my first subject is the seats, and since we've been talking about seats, there was a New York Times article here back in November of 12, if everybody remembers, last month American Airlines grounded a dozen Boeing 757 airliners after passenger seats came loose in four flights. Just a few weeks earlier, another American plane, a Boeing 767, was grounded after a problem was reported with the installation of some seats. But in that case, the seats didn't actually come loose. Now, why are seats all of a sudden, now they have come loose over the years, and as a maintenance person, I have been personally involved with installing seats and how they, all the different types of clamps and nuts and bolts and everything that hold the seats in. They're held in mostly by four, what we call foot type seats, and they're used in a vise type gripping mechanism. But what was happening was why we're having the problem lately is that American, like other carriers in the midst of, they were reconfiguring its coach section to give more leg room for economy seats, you know, to get extra space. It was creating three rows instead of four rows, and the airlines didn't charge more for the seats, which was called main cabin extras. Now, if you've been up with the news, you know that the airline is going through a bankruptcy. So they hired outside maintenance people, which we'll talk to you a little bit later. But the document showed that some of the workers didn't understand how to properly install the seats. And now the FAA administration has opened up an investigation into the seat problem. Just a footnote on that, and for me, is that most seats are held in by four quarter-inch bolts that are attached to a cone-shaped foot. It's locked into a track that is set into the floor along the complete length of the cabin of the aircraft. And you slide these little foots, we call them, into holes and then slide them forward, and there's a locking mechanism that locks it up on the rails. If you don't know how to do that, or you're not very competent at it, or you haven't had the expertise like we'll discuss later on, they can come loose. And I think now that they're reconfiguring a lot of these aircraft, and basically it's just to get more revenue. We in the airplane business know that there's only so much room in a cabin, and so consequently the only way you're going to start getting more seats in is push the seats closer together. And we'll talk about this a little later on.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, Chuck, I've got a question here.
Okay.
The new aircraft, the new generation airplanes, don't have the typical seat, three abreast or two and then three or two on three on each side and five in the middle or whatever on the stretched, the wide-bodied airplanes. But now it looks like a call center with all cubes, and the seats are cubical in that you have your own entertainment center and things like that. So you have a seat that makes a bed, and you have all of your entertainment right there. So it really is almost luxury feature there that a person, I guess maybe they're trying to woo up the cruise ship passengers back to the airplanes by having all the amenities that they enjoy now in these new modern airplanes like the Dreamliner and I'm sure the future airplanes and the Airbus A380. Wonder how they lock the cubes into place.
I don't personally have any knowledge of the exact fixture that they're using, but I assure you that it's most likely runs along because Boeing is the one that come up with the track idea a long, long time ago. Even the 707s that came out in the 50s have tracks. And I think the FAA is more inclined to allow the airlines to have this track mechanism because you have to realize that you have to take these seats out in different phase checks that they have. Usually they're every 5 years, but sometimes they'll go in and do a intermediate phase check and they take the seats out. So consequently, if you permanently bolt them to the floor, it's going to be very expensive to get these seats in and out. So I'm almost assured that they have some kind of tracking system.
Yeah, you know, seat 1A in a Boeing Dreamliner looks like room 101 at the Marriott.
Yeah, I've seen that picture, and you're right.
So they're beautiful. It's absolutely fascinating what the future aircraft is going to look like interior-wise.
Well, I've seen Korean Air just got cited as the most comfortable and airline flying because they have these cubicles that you're talking about in their aircraft. And you're right. They look like, you know, you're sleeping at the Hilton.
Well,
their commercials are not bad either.
Yes.
Yeah. Jim, back to you.
Okay, I think we ought to continue on to Steve Thompson regarding the recent article in all of the media about the closing of the control towers and Latin America flying. Steve?
Well, Jim, as most everybody is aware, the federal government will close 173 air traffic control towers at small and medium-sized airports on April 7th because of forced spending cuts. It will close another 16 towers on September 30th at the end of the fiscal year. Now, the FAA said it would consider removing individual towers from the list on a case-by-case basis if the operators can explain why in the national interest it is in the national interest to keep them open. We're extremely discouraged and disappointed the FAA is taking this action, Dickerson, who is head of the Air Traffic Control Association, said. The rest of the FAA budget is getting a 5% haircut. The control towers are getting a 75% haircut. Because the FAA is cutting 189 of the 251 contract towers. The towers are part of the FAA's contract tower program, in which 251 towers are staffed with contractors instead of FAA employees. Though little known, contract towers are widely used by the FAA to manage air traffic. Such towers handle approximately 28% of all control tower operations, although the towers being cut account for a little less than 6% of the commercial airline operations. John Cozart, CEO of Robinson Aviation, which staffs contract towers in the south and the southwestern U.S., said the decision was not unexpected. I didn't think they'd resolve it in favor of the contract tower program. I kind of expected that they would continue on their course. Tower closures could not necessarily result in airport closures because some aircraft can land without aircraft traffic control help, and this should say all aircraft can land without air traffic control help. And those that need controller help can communicate with more distant FAA facilities. A 2011 report by the Department of Transportation Office of the Inspector General said contract towers cost an average of $537,000 a year to operate compared with $2 million for a comparably busy FAA staff tower. The lower costs are chiefly from lower staffing and salary levels at contract towers, which had an average of 6 controllers, while FAA towers had 16. A typical contract controller near Tampa received a base pay of $56,000 a year, compared with the base pay ranging from $63,000 to $85,000 a year for an FAA controller in Sarasota, Florida. I've long believed that many of these control towers at these smaller airports are unnecessary. An airport on the list that is familiar to me is Hilton Head. In the case of Hilton Head, I believe the decision to build and operate the tower was a political one made by politicians and not based on safety. Just before this decision and the bond letting was made to construct the tower, an accident occurred just short of the airport, resulting in the death of the pilot. His widow, with no flying experience, got notoriety from the local press by making a statement that if there had been a control tower there, her husband would still be alive, and the accident had nothing to do with air traffic control. It was caused by him running out of fuel. The local press made a big deal of this statement, and the politicians who knew nothing about flying jumped on this with both feet. My point is that so many of these decisions are made by politicians having very little aviation safety knowledge. Instead of having aviation safety experts evaluate each of these airports for closing, some bureaucrat says, okay, we're going to close all of them having a certain traffic, below a certain traffic volume. I believe most of this is fluff spending at taxpayers' money, which probably should have been, not have been spent at all, Jim.
Well, that is something. It's unfortunate, but I can give you first-hand info. Like up in New Haven, Connecticut, the service at the airport diminished considerably when there was a limousine service that started up and served all of the New York airports. And rather than waiting for an airplane to take you from New Haven, Tweed New Haven Airport, over to either LaGuardia, Kennedy, or Newark, they could ride the limousine at a little less cost and with an awful lot more in the way of assurance they're going to get there. The weather was not a factor. Neil, you're going to tell us a bit about Ten Rock Plaza and the Reba Wall of Fame.
Well, before we get there, Jim, I've got a comment or two, and maybe Bob Furman and Chuck, you have comments also on tower closings, but my little brother called me. He's now really gung-ho on aviation, owns 3 airplanes now, and seems like all the airports that he operates from, Fort Myers, Naples, and Marathon, all had contract tower operators, and they're all closing down. Now, my idea is that the cities subsidize tower operations. For instance, St. Augustine, right here about 9 miles from our studio, announced that it's also in the closure of the towers. And they've been talking or writing articles in the paper about, and as a matter of fact, been on television, about how some of the corporations that have jets can't fly into an uncontrolled tower because of insurance reasons. So they are really, you know, trying to figure out what they can do to get tower operators back into the towers. And I think the cities should consider, okay, let's say we have 4 employees that operate the towers during the week at $50,000 each. That's $200,000 to be added to the budget. So now we can pay contract control tower operators and keep the airport controlled, a control feel. But, heck, I can remember, and, Steve, you too, I'm sure, that we used to fly Convairs and Electras and even 727s into uncontrolled airports. Do you remember those days, Steve?
I remember so well. And to back up my feeling on this, I remember an air show at the Hilton Head Airport, and it must have had, and I was listening to the Unicom frequency, which all the pilots were using to control themselves from each other, there must have been 15 to 20 airplanes in and around that airport all the time, and there was never a conflict. They handled themselves and controlled themselves just perfectly. That would never have happened if there had been a control tower there that would have restricted the airplanes to probably less than half of that.
Well, if I were on the county commission here in St. John's County where I live, I certainly would recommend to the council or the commissioners that we consider budgeting for control tower operators. Put it in our budget, and let's keep the St. Augustine Airport controlled. And that way we keep our some of our Fortune 500 people have resort properties here in St. Augustine. And, of course, now they have to land at Hurlong Field, which is west of the Jacksonville Airport, Jacksonville International, and also Craig Field and Cecil Field. So that's quite a distance from the air, from the city. And so, there's a way of keeping some of these towers operational. And I think they'll probably see that one of these days.
I agree that. And the state of Texas has agreed to fund all of the 13 airports that the FAA was going to close down. And this was initiated by Governor Perry, who himself is an experienced pilot.
I'm voting for Perry next time.
Yes.
Even though he loses his memory from time to time. Back to you, Jim.
Well, I think, Neil, you're the next one up here at Ten Rock Plaza and discussing the REPA Wall of Fame.
Yeah, the Ten Rock Center and Ten Rock Plaza has held a special interest to me. And I, as a matter of fact, I think they have some kind of Ten Rock or something like that. It's probably nothing to do with New York City, but I find it a great address that Eastern once had, and that's Ten Rock Rockefeller Plaza, not Center, but Rockefeller Plaza. And I just wanted to bring people up to date as to why we went there, and who put us there, and when we left New York as the main headquarters of Eastern Airlines. In 1938, Captain Eddie was made manager of Eastern Airlines with offices in the General Motors building, of course, that being in Detroit. With traffic interest increasing and Eastern expanding, it was now necessary to find better office facilities in the New York area. One day, Captain Eddie was tipped that Pan American was negotiating for space in the new Rockefeller Center. With unconventionality, of course, Captain Eddie quickly called Lawrence Kirkland, in charge of handling the center's leasing contracts. The conversation went something like this. This is from Captain Eddie. You're an Eastern stockholder, and Lawrence Rockefeller is on our board. What the hell are you negotiating with Tripp, meaning Juan Tripp? What are you negotiating with Tripp for? Come over to Eastern. We need the new space. What the captain had in mind was an airline building in the new complex of several buildings. He met with Kirkland and Rockefeller agreed to sign a 10-year lease for top floor quarters and got them to go ahead with the other scheme that he had in mind. That was the skyscraper housing. EAL's offices would be called the Eastern Airlines Building. For a dramatic closing to the agreement, Beverly Griffith, had another idea. He talked Rickenbacker and the Rockefeller interest into signing the leasing agreement in an Eastern DC-3 cruising over Rockefeller Center. The Eastern Airlines building remained Eastern's headquarters until Frank Borman moved it to Miami International Airport, calling it the Tale of Two Cities. Borman said, how the hell can you run an organization when half of it is in one place and half in the other? Thus, do any of you, by the way, know the present tenant of Rockefeller Plaza, 10 Rock Plaza.
No, I'm sorry, Neil. I worked there for 8 years and before I left in 1968, but I don't remember who came in.
Well, Rockefeller Center was named after, of course, John D. Rockefeller, who leased the space from Columbia University in 1928 and developed it from 1930. And there are several buildings in that complex. And believe it or not, that building, all of those buildings in the Rockefeller Center complex was built for an estimated $250 million. It sounds like a lot of money. And it was a staggering sum in 1930, but can you imagine what that would be in today's dollars? But at any rate, Eastern had the top floors of the building, and they also took up some additional space. And the it's very interesting if you go on the Internet. The 10 Rock Center, or correction, 10 Rock Plaza, where Eastern's headquarters was, we had the building had 288,000 square feet. And it was originally called the Holland House, by the way, named after Neil Holland, perhaps. And the landmark buildings comprise over 8 million square feet on 22 acres in Midtown, and it's bounded by 5th and 6th Avenues and running from 48th Street to 51st Street. Rockefeller Center is also a private property, and it's co-owned now by the Tishman Spear and open to the public. But NBC News occupies the bottom floors there of the Rockefeller Plaza. So it's interesting to know where we were and where we wound up in Miami, Building 16. Jim, that's all I have.
All right. Our listeners might like to know also that the famous Rockettes are in that area as well. You might remember at Christmas time they have a beautiful program. Now, I have a subject that since I was with the airline so long and I was close to this thing, it has to do with lost luggage. You know, way back, I think it was at least 20 or 25 years ago, you know, with a borrowed pickup truck and a $300 loan, second-generation entrepreneur Doyle Owens heads out to Washington, D.C. to purchase his first load of unclaimed baggage from Trailways bus lines, selling the contents on card tables in an old rented house. It didn't take long for Doyle to realize that his idea was a winner. And within a month, he leaves his insurance job and becomes the bag man full-time. With a whopping 99.5% of domestic airlines, checked bags are picked up by their owners at the baggage carousel. Roughly one-half or 1% don't arrive with the passengers. 5 days later, an impressive 95% of those delayed bags find their way home. That's a great track record considering the hundreds of millions of flights and passengers that crisscross the country and the globe every day. An intense three-month search process reunites over half of the remaining bags with the happy passengers. Claims are paid to the astonishingly small fraction of a percent of owners whose bags are never found. Only after these exhaustive attempts to reunite the bag with the owners do the airlines call in the crew from Unclaimed Baggage Center. Unclaimed Baggage Center is under contract with airlines and other transportation companies to purchase the luggage that can't be traced to the owners. Truckloads of lost luggage are transported to Scottsboro, Alabama, sight unseen. After its long journey, the unclaimed baggage arrives dirty, in the same disarray, and often damaged. Our experienced staff carefully unpacks the bag, wearing protective gloves. The items go through a complex sorting process, the clothes headed for a store go to our own dry cleaner and laundry facility. Can you imagine that? The largest commercial dry cleaner in the state of Alabama. Fine jewelry is cleaned and appraised. Meanwhile, our technicians test all of the electronics equipment, and they want to make sure that these items, when they are put up for sale, are in great working condition. Finally, the experts with 10, 15, or even 25 years of pricing experience research and price each individual item. By the time merchandise is wheeled onto the sales floor, the clothes, the products are in new or nearly new condition, ready to be snapped up by savvy shoppers. Some of the bought in bulk load not going to the rental floor is voted off the island, so to speak. These items should never have been packed into suitcases in the first place. We've learned over the years that some people will pack anything that fits into a bag, alive, dead, stinky, or illegal. Did we mention the live rattlesnake we found? Over half of these leftover items, however, are reclaimed for good. Our numerous charity partners repose merchandise to meet needs all over the world. In short, we will donate, recycle, and repurpose everything we can. Bags and boxes that arrive at UBC filled with a wide variety of items have a second shot at being worn, played with, read, or shared. Imagine the clothing and products that arrive from around the world at UBC going out once again after a distant, often too distant parts of the world. You might like to know that unclaimed baggage is located at 509 West Willow Street in Scottsboro, Alabama. Telephone is 256-259-1525. They're open Monday to Friday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. They're closed on Sundays. This is a fantastic business that was started by this young man many, many years ago. I'm pleased to learn about it. After all these years, I never knew where the lost or unclaimed baggage ever went. That's my story.
Well, I have a comment. They had a special on either or 60 Minutes or one of those shows, evening shows, about the Alabama operations and the people around several states, how they go on a certain day when new material or new merchandise arrives at the center and is put on shelves so they can purchase. I understand that there's some great buys, and it's a huge facility there. So it was a great idea.
Well, let's continue here. Now, that's just, wow, what a variety of subjects we're covering. Let's go to the second round of subjects open for discussion. Margaret, do you have something for us?
I sure do. I'd like to discuss an act of kindness by Delta Airlines recently. You know, we hear so much negativity these days about airlines, so it's really nice to hear something that's uplifting. Now, according to a March 20th article, a Delta employee ordered 60 pizzas for delayed passengers on an Atlanta-bound flight from Tennessee after the plane was stranded on the tarmac for 3 hours on Monday due to severe weather conditions. Now, the Department of Transportation rules does require airlines to allow passengers to leave a plane after a three-hour tarmac delay and to provide food and water after 2 hours. Pizza, on the other hand, is not required, and neither is a police escort for the food. And, yes, there was a police escort for the pizzas. So Delta reportedly worked with TSA to clear the delivery through security, and the police car had its lights flashing and, you know, made sure that the pizzas arrived safely and soundly. Now, all the passengers were really excited about that. They said the pilot kept the mood light and the flight attendants busted their butts, quote-unquote, to keep us hydrated. They said the only regret was that there was no beer that came with the pizza. Now, I sure hope that that Pizza Hut delivery guy was given a lot of good tips, Neil, on that one.
Well, that reminds me, I was on a L-1011 flight, and we were in Chicago in the wintertime, and snow on the ground, and then we had on top of that a mechanical problem, and we were trying to go from Chicago to, I believe it was Miami, or it could have been Atlanta, and I remember people were so frustrated, and we didn't have that many people that night. It was a late departure out of Chicago O'Hare, but our flight attendants took it upon themselves. The flight attendants Eastern had were of this caliber person. But the senior flight attendant took a collection of the flight attendants and ordered pizzas for all of the people on the airplane. And and those people were so, happy about that and stayed with us. And they had no complaints. And we finally got off the ground. I think we were about 2 hours late. But, yeah, it sounds on a small scale what Delta did on a big scale that you just mentioned. Steve, you ever have any happenings like that?
I don't recall that, but when I first was married, my wife worked for Delta Airlines and at the Kennedy Airport, which then was called Idlewild. And they had a young mother and a baby who missed a flight, and she could not afford to get a hotel room. So my wife brought this mother and her daughter home to spend the night with us until she could get a flight out the next day. And that got her a CE Woman Award for Employee of the Month.
And that's fantastic.
Hey, Neil?
Yeah.
Bob? Talking about crew meals, Brenda just called me from the back and said, my crew meal's ready. I need to go.
All right, Bob.
I'll see you guys.
Chicken or steak?
We're having pork tonight, pork loin. Okay. We'll see you. Thank you.
Okay. First class.
First class, right. Bye.
Well, all I've got, Jim. Chuck, I'll turn it back to you, Jim.
All right. Steve, do you have anything further?
Yeah, I have some subject about the Latin American routes flying the American Airlines or flying the Latin America routes that we purchased from, that Eastern purchased from Braniff in 1982, for which they paid like $30 million. And as a side note to this, they were sold to American for some 8 years later for around $1,417 million. Which is a nice profit for Texas Air. Now, for a pilot flying these routes, some of these procedures and rules that we dealt with dated back to the 1950s and 60s in the U.S. But for the pilots, it was fun flying because, for the most part, you were kind of on your own. Traffic separation was based on time instead of radar. And in the beginning, the only radar on the routes was Panama, Lima, and Buenos Aires. And these radar sites had limited range since most were only about 50 miles from the airport. Now, being qualified on the 1011 based in Miami, I had the opportunity of flying these routes. And after an accident we had in La Paz in which we lost the 727 in the mountain, our VP of Flying Operations decided we needed a Manager of Operations of Latin America, and I was appointed to that position, which included setting up a training program for pilots to complete before they were permitted to fly these routes. It also included there happened to be a Czech airman flying with a captain into certain airports such as Bogota, Quito, and La Paz, and Honduras. These routes presented some challenges. The terrain, short runways, limited navigational aids, and complex approaches made flying these routes both exciting and testing our flying skills. It also provided some opportunities for innovative flying. As an example, in the U.S., there was a 250-knot speed restriction below 10,000 feet above the terrain. And I remember flying a 727 into La Paz and flying a downwind leg to a landing at an airspeed of 390 knots and watching the terrain go by from a low altitude was thrilling, but it was perfectly safe. Now, the most complex airport was Quito. Because of the runway slope, you had to land to the north and take off in the same direction because of the terrain. In our training program, we created a maneuver that taught you, the escape maneuver to avoid the mountains while climbing out of the valley after losing an engine just after takeoff. Now, another factor for some of the routes was a fatigue element. There was a daily flight that left Miami at 7 p.m. and arrived in Buenos Aires the next day at 10 a.m. Buenos Aires time, which was some 14 hours on duty. Now, it was difficult to stay awake, and I counseled pilots that if they felt they could not hold their eyes open, to make sure the other pilot was awake and alert and take a 15-minute nap, even though it was against the rules. There would be on occasions where I would be called out the last minute to fill in as captain or first officer without proper rest time before the flight. And I counseled the other pilots the same way, and I felt it far safer to have both pilots alert during the most critical part of the flight for approach and landing. Any comments?
I'm sure the La Paz operation, and you flew into La Paz several times, or many flights, Steve? Did you check the crews out?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, what a operation that was, and of course the tragedy there would I guess maybe we could discuss that at a future show, but what went wrong. But I've been on the internet looking at YouTube of some of the airports that are extremely difficult to get into or either depart from. As a matter of fact, I was looking at one tonight, Manusa, something like that. I don't even know what country it was in, but I was just absolutely fascinated with the airplane when it took off. Immediately in front of them was a sloping mountain that they had to pass over and then make an immediate turn to the right to go down down into a valley. And then, because the valley was closed off in front of them, they had to make another turn. They had to be at 8,700 feet at a certain point. And the terrain alert system on the terrain avoidance system was constantly going off, and they were shutting it down because they were always so close to the ground. The proximity, terrain proximity alarm was going off. So it's absolutely fascinating of some of the airports that we're going into, and most of our listeners can see that on YouTube. Just go to difficult airports just in your browser to take off and land. It's absolutely fascinating. And La Paz and Quito. I did that approach on a Delta Airlines simulator, and I was absolutely fascinated flying a 767 into Quito and departing from Quito, but that was in the simulator only. But absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure you spent some pucker time in the seat there, Steve, a couple of times.
Oh, yes, and there were some things that you could do to bend the rules a little bit, which did not compromise safety. But since there was no radar, you could take off from Lima, and you went nonstop to Buenos Aires, and the flight plan had you going down the coastline to Santiago, Chile, and then across to the east to Buenos Aires. Now, the weather was good and you were very tired and you could save about 40 minutes of flight time by going nonstop from Lima to Buenos Aires. And there was a little period of time in there where that had you lost an engine, you may have had some real pucker factor avoiding the hills until you got on the other side of the mountains. But that was something that I've heard other pilots did.
Yeah.
And one of the guys' name was Steve, as I remember.
Ooh.
Jim, back to you. I think we still have time for a little discussion about maintenance from Chuck.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we got a few minutes. I'll just kind of go over this lightly here. What we were doing is I wanted to talk about contract maintenance. We've had contract maintenance all the time that I was in the airline business, but normally they were for smaller airlines. Now we're talking about contract maintenance for American Airlines, and they have had this seat problem, so now the company is saying that they have licensed employees, A&P licensed employees on the site at these different contract places, but unfortunately, they have one A&P mechanic, so to speak, in a supervisory position for 20 unlicensed mechanics. Now, they're saying that that's okay. Now, the union argued that American switched from its own unionized mechanics and was putting the passenger at risk. It can't just have anyone doing the maintenance, said Larry Pike, president of the Transport Workers Union Local 567, which represented the airlines, mechanics, and you just can't pull over in the sky and fix something if you hear something go thump. Well, the airlines countered and said that they never put the passenger safety at risk, and it never at any time compromised safety and reliability of their fleet. But in October, they offered a set of explanation for the seat problems, blaming it on clamps used to hold the seats in place. Later, they said that the accumulation of soda that people spill on the floor and coffee and dirt made the seat tracks dirty and prevented the clamps from locking properly. Now they say, in part, it did not work as designed to work. So the airline said in an advisory to mechanics that a contributing factor was the incorrect installation of the seat track. Well, the tracks are not installed improperly. They come from the factory. So I can't go along with that. But the FAA is looking into whether the contracting work was properly supervised at American and several other people with the knowledge of the investigation. And what they're trying to find out is if the seats that they're moving around to make more room for these extra leg room for people that's going to pay for it, you also have to move all the wiring. You have to do the overhead lighting locations, the oxygen mask. These are all done by moving when you move the seats. So what becomes of the work that's being done incorrectly or correctly as the people are doing the work? Although four flights with loose seats made the news in October, the airline knew, RA knew that one of its contractors had trouble installing seats. The contractor was Certified Aviation Services of San Diego, was hired to work on the Boeing 767. It told American in August 28, that it might have installed the seats incorrectly. In review, American wrote that the workers misinterpreted the aircraft maintenance manual, and the entire CAS vendor crew was coached and canceled on September the 4th about the importance of asking for help when there's a doubt as to accomplish the task. Now, I put in a lot of seats personally in my career, and I didn't have to go ask people how to put seats in. If I wanted to know something about seats, I would go to their reader printers or their computers, and I would sit down and read what I had to do from the aircraft manufacturers. I think contract maintenance in some instance is a very good thing. Another instance, when you're trying to hurry things along and use uncertified personnel, I think it's bad. That's my personal opinion.
Our extra cushion, but we're not going to take that.
Okay,
well,
carry on.
Yeah, okay. Well, because we're getting time sensitive here, I would like to thank Retired Eastern Pilots Association for once again sponsoring the Eastern Airlines Radio Show. Thank you very much, REPA. And this is the second year in a row that they have chosen to sponsor our little gig here. And we're very happy. So I want to tell you a little bit about what the Retired Eastern Pilots Association has done in keeping the memory of Eastern Airlines alive. For many years now, we've had a memorial wall at the Atlanta-Hartsfield International Airport. It's located over there on, in the Continental Airlines area or AirTran area. And every time pilots would pass away during the year, a plaque would be added and remembering the deceased pilots from the very beginning all the way up until when that plaque was made for that current year. And because of space and the fact that there are several of the Eastern pilots, of course, still alive, they decided that they would take and make the plaques of all the Eastern pilots that ever worked for Eastern Airlines that could be identified. And Jerry Frost led that team effort to get all of the pilots' names, as many as and as accurately as he could. And they have now plaques in the Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport of every pilot, over 6,000 pilots that have been identified on those plaques at the airport. So if you ever get the occasion to go into the lobby, ticket counter area, you'll see these beautiful plaques. But you can also see them on the Internet. Go to REPA Online, R-E-P-A, Online, O-N-L-I-N-E, all one word, repaonline.com, and there you will see how to go to the wall at the airport, and you can zoom in on each panel and see the pilots' names and when they were hired with Eastern. So it was quite a project, and it was really a great effort made by several people there in the Atlanta area. And I think Jerry deserves a great hand about the way it was done. And Jim Holder, the REPA editor, repartee, editor of the magazine, and Bob Draughty, the president, last year. But they install those, so you might want to, if you're going through the Hartsfield Terminal, go into the lobby, and I'm not certain exactly where it can be found, but you can find that on repaonline.com and find all about where to find it and how it was placed in that. Delta doesn't have one, or any other airline, have that distinction of having all of its employees remembered at the Atlanta airport. And I think it was a great effort, and it will definitely keep Eastern Airlines, the legend of Eastern Airlines, alive for many, many years. So that's all I have, Jim. And
right.
I think we're about out of time.
Yes, it looks like that. I'm glad we could get together tonight, and thanks to our host for making an interesting conversation. To our hundreds of listeners around the world, we hope we can do it again next Monday at the same time and same place on your internet dial. Remember, we want you to be with us, and we want to be with you for a full hour, so remember Neil's special request. Our sign-off bumper music, which should be on there in a moment, tells me that we're about out of time for this week's show. As you know, all of our radio shows go by episode numbers, and we are about to put episode number 110 into the radio archives, where you may listen again to this episode or any of the other 109 episodes that we've had during the past 2 years that we've been broadcasting. Tell your friends about the show. More importantly, get involved with the rest of our hosts by participating in the broadcast. Just remember, call in the numbers that we have given you, and press number 1 on your phone, and you'll be in with our host. You're welcome to participate live and on the air each Monday. We're proud of the fact that this show is the only airline company radio show of its kind. It's part of the way we are keeping the memory of Eastern Airlines alive. We are the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Well, that's all for tonight, and from all of our hosts, we say good night, Eastern family and friends.
Good night, friends.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
I know it. It's just absolutely so. I think so. Maybe a skit. Maybe another skit. Yeah.
But that's a good show. I've learned a lot listening to
that. That was so good. That was really good. End of the episode.